This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Friday, January 17th. I'm John Wanamaker. About 1,300 people crowded into a Duluth hall last night to praise, poke holes, and otherwise comment on the environmental analysis of the proposed Polymet copper-nickel mine. While sharp differences of opinion were expressed, the discussion remained civil, as Dan Crocker reports.
As hundreds of people streamed into the deck in Duluth last night, a sticker war took place. Polymet opponents handed out Protect Clean Water stickers, while Polymet supporters, including Dave Lislegard, passed out bright blue We Support Mining stickers.
Well, it's about people standing strong for their way of life. This is a great project. LTV Steel, that guy is wearing, I work there.
Lislegard greets a man wearing an LTV Steel hat. The taconite plant in Hoyt Lakes shut down in 2001, laying off more than 1,000 workers.
I lost my job there, but we're hoping that Polymet will bring back new jobs and support our families for generations to come. Come on in, guys.
Lislegard helped organize 7 busloads carrying more than 500 mining supporters from the Iron Range. Inside, 19-year-old McAllister College student Justin Randall also handed out stickers. The Sierra Club intern drove up from St. Paul. He says it's pretty easy to identify his target audience.
There's people in suits or and Carhartts, or there's people in like Patagonia-related outdoor gear.
Randall was raised in a small mining town in Montana. He says the mine did good things for his town. He played basketball on a court paid for by the mining company there. But he says it also caused water pollution, and he's worried Polymet would do the same.
Unfortunately, this is not the taconite mining that northern Minnesota has such a strong heritage of. This is entirely different. This is poisonous.
Polymet has proposed a 20-year mining operation outside Hoyt Lakes that would carve copper, nickel, and precious metals out of a rich mineral deposit known as the Duluth Complex. The project would create 360 direct jobs and hundreds more indirect and construction jobs, and it would pump hundreds of millions of dollars into the regional economy. 84-year-old former state legislator Joe Bagich voiced strong support for Polymet.
I live in an area in the midst of the middle of the mines of the Evelyn Taconite. 9 feet from my driveway is Evelyn Taconite. I don't have a problem. They live by their good rules. Why can't we all get together and live the proper way and open that mine and provide long-paying jobs for our area, for our youngsters?
Speakers at the meeting were given 3 minutes to comment on the 2,000-plus page environmental analysis of the project. While there were more Polymet supporters in attendance, a majority of the 80 people who commented opposed the project. The most common theme to emerge was the prospect of long-term treatment of the water at the mine site and at the tailings basin. Here's Jane Whitledge of Duluth.
The water will have to be treated for at least 200 years. The lack of common sense and the stupidity of it all is breathtaking that we'd even consider fouling our own water forever.
Early drafts of the EIS said water at the mine site would require treatment for 200 years and for 500 years at the tailings basin. But the version released to the public says only that treatment will be long-term and that modeling shows that treatment will meet water quality standards for hundreds of years. But Don Arnasty with the Audubon Society said it's still unclear how that treatment will be paid for.
There are no details in this SDEIS that would explain how this magic water treatment system is going to be paid for 200, 300, 400 years from now. That alone is sufficient to say this document's incomplete. This is an inappropriate proposal.
Polymet will be required to put up money up front, called financial assurance, to pay for any potential problems down the road. The DNR has said many of those details would be included in the project's permitting phase. Many supporters of the project praised Minnesota's tough environmental regulations, saying they trusted the state's regulators to ensure the project doesn't pollute. Roger Scraba is the former mayor of Ely and currently a wilderness fishing guide.
And I trust the process. I trust that the mining, when it happens, it's going to be done properly. And if it's not, then I'm out of a job.
The next public hearing for Polymet is scheduled for next Wednesday in Aurora, just down the road from the proposed mine. The public has until March 13th to weigh in on one of the most controversial environmental issues Minnesota has faced in decades. With help from Elizabeth Dunbar, I'm Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
A new report from Minnesota's legislative auditor says state lawmakers should decide whether it's appropriate for the governor to use a state airplane to travel to political events. Tim Pugmire has more.
After reviewing three flights that DFL Governor Mark Dayton took on a state plane in 2012, legislative auditor James Nobles concluded that Minnesota has no consistent standard for determining if trips that include political events are lawful. He said if such trips are allowable, they should be authorized in state law along with a reimbursement requirement.
There is a line that needs to be drawn at some point so that public resources are not being inappropriately used for political activity.
The report said it was a violation of state law when one of Dayton's political aides flew on the plane with him. In response, Dayton's office said it was an error that won't happen again. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
New details have emerged about the data breach that affected Target over the holiday season. Matt Sepik reports.
Hackers installed malware on Target's cash registers and stole about 40 million debit and credit card numbers. They also took the names, email, and street addresses of 70 million customers. EyeSight Partners, a Dallas company that focuses on cyber threat intelligence, is working with the federal government to investigate the breach. Tiffany Jones, a senior vice president at EyeSight, says Russian words were found in one of the variants of the virus, and parts of the malware were developed by a Russian criminal.
That does not in any way, shape, or form indicate or show attribution that the attack or the operation was Russian in origin.
Jones says the malware first started appearing for sale in black market online forums in February and March of last year. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The two sides in the dispute over funding for the new Vikings Stadium have filed paperwork with the Minnesota Supreme Court. A one-time Minneapolis mayoral candidate challenged the constitutionality of the stadium bonds last week, bringing the expected sale to a halt. Minnesota Management and Budget, the state's finance agency, says the bonds are legal and the sale should go ahead. The Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority says the bonds need to be sold by next week to pay $28 million worth of construction bills and keep the project on track. Opponents say a $150 million contribution by the city of Minneapolis to the project is improper and should have been put to voters who capped city spending on stadiums at $10 million in 1997. This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. The Minnesota Orchestra says it is not yet ready to announce concert details now that the 15-month musician lockout is over. But as UN Care reports, it has revealed an outline of the season.
Orchestra management and musicians are creating a 12-week subscription season of 37 concerts, but there are still many questions. First and foremost, will Osmo Venska return as music director? Venska resigned during the lockout. He's been in contact with a member of NPR's classical music staff talking about the new situation, but has not outlined his plans. Orchestra president and CEO Michael Henson said they will only have 3 weeks to sell the concert season, something that typically happens over a period of months. UN Care, Minnesota Public Radio News.
State regulators are looking to modernize the rules that govern large-scale composting facilities in Minnesota. As Elizabeth Baer reports, there's a proposal to add a new category to the state's current composting rules. It would include organic material, like food and yard debris, that's separated from other waste before it reaches a composting facility.
The first thing you notice when you walk into the Full Circle Organics facility near Good Thunder is the foul smell of rotting food. It comes from a large pile of trash in one corner of the building.
Got the hamburger buns, looks like baked beans, pizza. We've got milk cartons, it looks like leftover food from a school.
Andy Hansen is vice president of business operations at Full Circle Organics, which operates the facility just south of Mankato. It's one of nine current source-separated composting facilities in Minnesota that operate under the state's most stringent regulations. Today's compost comes from the Mankato Public Schools, a co-op in St. Peter, and a couple coffee shops in the area. Roughly 200 pounds of organic trash sits on a heated floor, which helps it warm up.
So once it's thawed out, we'll take it out, put it into that mixer, and they'll put in a carbon source, leaves, grass, corn stalks, and I'll show you, we've got a bunch of our carbon out there, and we'll mix it and we'll take it out to the pad, and put it into a windrow.
The mixture will decompose outdoors on a concrete pad for about 6 to 8 months. When the process is complete, it's sold for landscaping. Landowner David Fitzsimmons and his brothers invested 10 acres of land and $1 million to build the compost facility, which opened last February. They haven't made a profit yet, but they're encouraged by the demand in the area.
Sounded like a good idea. I think it still does. You know, we have been farming and raising hogs for almost 40 years, and we're ready for a new venture. We like doing something new like this that is, we think, the right thing to do and something that's becoming more and more popular, I think.
The new state rule change would add a specific compost category for facilities like this one that accept source-separated organics and make it easier for others to open around Minnesota. It would be the first change to the state's composting rules in more than two decades. Tim Farnan is an organics and recycling specialist with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. He says the new rule would set standards that are more strict than the existing rules for yard waste facilities, but less strict than municipal solid waste facilities.
Current facilities would have an opportunity to store material in different ways and to move composting material off their pad that has stormwater and groundwater protections at an earlier point in the composting process. So that'll expand the capacity they have.
About 40% of the garbage Minnesotans throw away is organic and compostable. Farnan says the state wants more of that to be composted.
Currently, we are capturing about 4% of the organic or of the waste in the state through organics recycling, and our goal is to get up to 15% managed through organics recycling by the year 2030.
The rule change would also expand the exemptions for smaller sites like universities and community gardens. And while it won't change the current operations in Good Thunder, Andy Hansen of Full Circle Organics says it could encourage growth and improve consumers' knowledge of the industry.
People think, you know, a lot of different things when they think composting. You know, think about that little barrel out in the back, but as you can see, our facility is quite big.
The composting rule change is currently in a public comment period through March 7th. If it's not contested, it'll go into effect by mid-year. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Good Thunder.
And lastly, music may once again fill a former St. Paul speakeasy, Curtis Gilbert reports.
If not for this song, the University Avenue building would probably be a parking lot. It was scheduled for the Wrecking Ball in 2009, but then amateur historian Kurt Gegenhuber discovered a tune on the Smithsonian Anthology of American Folk Music was recorded by the Victoria Cafe House Band in 1927.
It was only after I understood that it was associated with one of the most important collections of sound ever released that it became associated with something deeply significant in the history of American culture.
On that basis, St. Paul designated the building historic. Now a nonprofit organization is raising money to turn it into a theater again. Tyler Olson coordinates the Victoria Theater Arts Initiative.
Whenever we talk to people about what the place is going to be, the number one thing that comes up every time is music.
Olson says that's fitting, considering it was music that saved the place. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
And that's the NPR News Update for Friday, January 17th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.